Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to audio and video content, episode archives, monthly roundtables, a book club, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that if you're listening to this podcast, you probably have some kind of online life, right? You've got a social media profile somewhere. You've got likes and dislikes, and the algorithm knows all of those. And you see ads. You see ads for things you haven't even spoken of out loud. You'll think of Pop-Tarts, and a couple of hours later, there is an ad for Pop-Tarts somewhere. It's one of those things that if you think about just a little too much, you start getting really grossed out really fast. But we still use the internet, right? I mean, we use it to download podcasts. We use it to find new ways to inspire us, to share our art, to share family photos, to find new kinds of music that perhaps we would never have listened to before. The internet connects us in a lot of really cool ways, so it's become a really integral tool to all of us. But the thing is, there's this urge online, right, to become a brand, to turn your life into its own kind of reality show. There is a way of living online at which you are carefully curating every bit of your existence to seem just a little bit more polished, a little bit cleaner, a little bit brighter, a little bit whiter than it really is. Slap a filter on it, brighten up those shelves, make it look farmhouse white. My guest today is Christine Platt, and she is an expert on minimalism, which is a concept of, at its core, as she says in her book, The Afro-Minimalist's Guide to Living with Less, the idea of minimalism is simply to live with less. And yet, you can look up minimalist anything, right? I mean, I looked up a minimalist refrigerator just because, you know, after my conversation with Christine, I was like, you know, I'm going to Google some of this. So I started putting in weird keywords, which led me to minimalist refrigerator. And the very first option for a minimalist refrigerator is $4,600. And that's the thing, right? You know, Christine is talks about, you know, I could search for a minimalist table, a minimalist closet organizer, all sorts of things. And so you end up spending more money, obscene amounts of money, to buy things because you think that that's how you fit into this aesthetic. Why? Because where does all of our research begin? It begins online. And we think that because of the ways that people who have turned themselves into brands so that they can market to you, so they can sell to you, because of the way that some of these people have presented the idea of minimalism, you think that you have to go spend all of this money to go be a minimalist. Christine even talks about that in her book, about how, you know, she wanted to get organized several years ago. So what was her first thought? I'm going to go to the Container Store. I'm going to go buy more things to put my things in. I'm going to go hide my things in things that I have to go buy so that I can be a minimalist, so that I can live with less. And she took a step back and thought, you know, maybe there is another way. And that's the focus of the conversation today. We talk about the fact that people feel overwhelmed in their own spaces, but we talk more so about the stress of comparison, about the way that we go online to try to find ways to make our lives better and end up feeling just a little bit worse, and then trying to find a way to spend our way into feeling better about ourselves, into turning our lives into a simulacrum of the branded people's lives that we see online. And we talk about, you know, being conscious of this, both as someone who is wanting to learn more about anything, minimalism or otherwise, and also about a person who puts themselves out there, who has to, by dint of the way social media works right now, create a brand of one. Being conscious of that sort of parasocial dynamic. It's an interesting conversation, and I'm really glad that Christine is here today to answer the question, how do I live intentionally with all this capitalism everywhere? Enjoy.
Hi, Christine Platt.
Hi. How are you?
I'm so good. It's so good to talk to you. Congratulations on all of the success of the Afro Minimalist Guide to Living with Less.
Thank you. It's so good to see you again.
Oh my gosh, you too. You have had such a journey with your book. So for folks who don't know, and at this point, I don't know how, because you've been on magazine covers, you are everywhere, you're on NPR. Tell folks a little bit about you, about your book.
Sure. So I am Christine Platt, otherwise known as the Afro Minimalist, just a Black woman trailblazing a new, trail journey in the minimalist space. I just have like a unique approach to living with less that really is more holistic and more inclusive and accessible. That's who I am. I'm also a writer, a mother, a friend, a sister, all of these things. That's how I am. And I'm also waking up from a nap, which feels amazing.
You're going to have to tell me the secrets to taking a nap during the day, because I if the sun is out, I cannot shut my eyes. I wish I could, because I'm old now and I would love a nap.
We'll have a little sidebar about that.
So it's January when we're recording this, and a new year always brings sort of that pressure to start fresh. And in the last several years, that leads people to these extreme views of just getting rid of stuff. Mm-hmm. And from what I've seen in my own life and the lives of people that I know and the lives of people on social media, you know, we do this big, bold statement of I'm going to get rid of all my stuff and start fresh and we are going to organize and all of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
2 days later,
suddenly your house is just junked back up, because suddenly you're buying more things and you're filling up all of those spaces that you cleaned out. So what do folks, I have to ask this bluntly, what are folks getting wrong about this time of year and the pressure that this time of year puts on people?
Yeah, I mean, I think we set a lot of unrealistic expectations in January, right? Decluttering our homes often just happens to be one of them. But there's something about the new year that people feel like really compelled to just like, I can start over, I can start anew, right? And I like to say, I mean, you can do that anytime, right? For a lot of people, their new year starts on their personal new year, which is their birthday, right? For some people, the start of every month is an opportunity to start over, right? I know even some people are like, every 24 hours, it's a restart. So I think, you know, putting this unrealistic pressure on ourselves every January 1st or the first month of the new year, I mean, I think that's the first sort of problem with just putting, it's just unnecessary, right? And so I think a lot of people get it wrong in the sense that there's nothing wrong with saying like, this is the year I'm going to start decluttering, right? But, putting this unnecessary weighted pressure on ourselves to do it all in a weekend or to do it all by the end of the month or to do, you know, and I'm saying this from experience because that was a big part of my journey and how I ended up surrounded by just a whole bunch of stuff, being like, what have I done, crying and sobbing, everything is in the middle of the floor. And I realized that was one of the things I did. I felt like, I have to get it done, you know, right now, this weekend. And it's just unnecessary, right? So setting some realistic goals, also like knowing yourself, a lot of people don't think about the amount of time that it's really going to take to even work through their closet, let alone their whole room. So, you know, a lot of decluttering professionals, one of the things that they recommend is however long you think it's going to take, it's probably going to take twice as long or three times as long.
So the minimalism / home organization worlds have a lot of overlap. Do you think they should? Do you think that home organization and minimalism share commonalities, or do you think that the reason why so many people get it wrong when they try to go minimalist is they're attacking it with home organization
tools.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot of commonalities there. Like, there's definitely some shared work. But I think the bigger part of when we think about minimalism, or, I like to say now, living with less, being a more mindful consumer, because minimalism evokes a certain type of aesthetic.
Sure.
I think it's really important. The part that home organization doesn't address is the psychology of ownership piece, which you and I have talked about many times, right? And so a lot of times people's homes are filling back up because they didn't get to the root cause of their overconsumption in the first place. All they did was declutter, right? They didn't figure out the why behind why they are buying so many things, right? They didn't figure out the why behind why it's so hard to let go. And so, like, I think that's sort of the missing link for a lot of people. And when it comes to home organization and sort of decluttering, is that it's just so much more than having a tidy home. If you just want to have a tidy home, that's home organization, get your bins and that sort of thing. But if the expectation is that you are really trying to reduce your consumption and sort of manage some of the things that you have, you got to dig deeper into the psychology of ownership, which is really understanding why you're motivated to purchase certain things and why it's so hard for you to let things go that, you no longer need, use, or love in your home.
It's interesting that you talk about the psychology of our attachment to things and overconsumption because it's something that isn't ever addressed. And I think you're probably the first. I don't want to say that you're the only because I have not done an exhaustive study of the industry, but you're certainly the first person that I ever experienced who talks about the psychology of why we want to purchase, why we want to consume, why we continue to buy things, even though our brain says, I can't afford it, I don't need it, I don't necessarily
You
want
like you
this.
literally just looked at the account. Like you know
Yeah.
you can't afford it, but you're like, but I have to have it, right? And so I
Yeah.
think, yeah, for me, that was such a missing link in my own journey. And I kind of wrote the book that I wish that I would have had, right? Like, I wish that I hadn't just looked at Pinterest and looked at a couple blogs, like, and like, oh, you just have to let go and you're gonna feel great, right? I wish that I had had something that really talked to me about the psychology of ownership and digging into, like, I had all these red sales tags. That was like a little clue for me, right? Like, where are these tags still on these things? What are all these sales stickers? Also wish that, I had really understood sort of the power behind the psychology of ownership when it comes to touch, which is, I'm sure you've seen on my Instagram, I joke a lot. I'm like, don't be going around touching everything, right? Because sometimes that's part of the issue, right? It's like,
Sure.
you don't have the money and you gave yourself the pep talk before you walked into that store with a little red dot. But then you touch something, right? And so understanding the power of touch when it comes to the psychology of ownership and how just that initial touch is like forming partial ownership. Those are the missing links, right? And I mean, I'm also not saying that I'm the first person to talk about it because I also have not done an exhaustive search, but it has made me excited to hear that from a lot of people. If I'm not the first person to talk about it, it's definitely not something that's talked about a lot when it comes to this. And I think, that's what's so important about the way this book has sort of shifted the movement is like we're moving away from aesthetics. It's really challenging people to look beyond minimalism as a design aesthetic and more of a practice and a lifestyle. And like, what does that really mean? And what does it entail? And what do you have to do to maintain it, right? Which is knowing your why. And all of our whys are different, right?
I want to dive into the psychology of it for just a second because there is a stress component, and stress affects our mental health, our physical health. 54% of Americans say that they feel overwhelmed by clutter. 66% of Americans say that living in a cluttered or dirty or disorganized home makes them feel overwhelming stress. And I thought something else that was interesting when I was prepping for the show was the average American household has over 300,000 items in it.
I just think that's interesting. And yes, I mean, yeah, sure. Okay, I buy a pack of 24 batteries, and I guess that's 24 items, but you just start thinking, like,
oh yeah, I remember reading
like
that
a lot
piece.
Of things.
I know where you read it. It's in, it was like in the LA Times or something. And I remember looking around my house and being like, yep. Maybe not 300,000, but easily 150.
Sure.
150,000, sure. Right?
But on the flip side, they tell us, okay, so you have a lot of things, you're feeling a lot of stress, and you want to grasp at something. And the thing is, what so many of us think of, okay, you have a solution, I will buy that solution from you. So the home organization industry is an $11.5 billion industry as of last year, while we're all locked up.
Oh,
and
God.
That has gone up over 20% every year for the last several years, however long they've been measuring it. And it's expected to go up another 20 to 25% this year. So talk to me a little bit about this loop, both that you discovered while writing the Afro-Minimalist Guide in your own journey, and maybe even from your readers about how that stress cycle impacts our overconsumption.
Yeah. So the stress is twofold, right? So the stress, I think there's the stress of having a lot of things, but then there's also just like the stress of life. And what happens is that our desire to seek comfort in things is heightened, right, in these sort of situations. So it's not surprising to me that, you know, home organization items that, you know, those sales went up when we were in the pandemic, right? I'm sure there are a couple different areas, including alcohol, that if you look at the sales numbers, right, like the numbers went up exponentially. And I think that's because there are certain things that we tend to gravitate to in heightened times of stress, right? So for some people, it's going to be like those areas where they do most of their emotional spending. And so they're like, man, I looked around and like all of a sudden I have like 60 more pairs of shoes that I purchased during the pandemic and I'm not going anywhere, right? And then for other people, that heightened stress leads to them being like looking around and saying like, I gotta get my house in order, right? And that goes, that piece is linked to feeling like you're not in control of anything else, and you just have to feel in control of something, right? And then there's just the accumulation of things that we have acquired over time, and we're just stressed because we don't know what to do with it. Like, what should I really do with my high school track uniform, right? Like, I know I'm never gonna wear it again. I know I'm never gonna, you know, run in it again. I don't even run anymore. Like, what am I supposed to do with it, right? Oh, so there's like this.
I feel very attacked right now, Christine Platt. I feel very attacked. What do I do with my Letterman jacket? What do I do with my boxes? I was so overachiever. What do I do with all those trophies and medals? Just in a storage container.
I know, you know, there's a writer, her name is Mo Brown. She's amazing, like first poet in residence at the Lincoln's, like just brilliant. And she had this amazing t-shirt collection of all these poetry slams that she had done over the years. I mean, like we're thinking like over the course of like 20 years, right? And she said, Christine, I love these shirts. I don't wear them anymore. I don't know what to do with them. There's no way I can, what can I do? And I told her to have them made into a blanket. And there was like this, so she has this beautiful blanket, like a patchwork quilt of all the poetry slams that she went to, right? And so it's finding ways to, you know, honor those pieces that you really want to hold on to, right? Like, I mean, shadow boxing is a wonderful way to honor some of those pieces. And I think, you know, it's also where you figure out, what do I really want to keep, right? I mean, I remember letting go of my track stuff from high school, right? Like, I don't want to look at it in a shadow box. It's okay to let it go. It's okay to let it go, right? And so, you know, being very strategic and asking yourself, like, why do I want to keep this Letterman jacket? And if it's something that it evokes a certain memory or something for you, right, then it is like, where can I shadow box this and maybe put it in a frame where it speaks to and tells a story? is part of my home's aesthetic as opposed to just being in a box. A lot of us hold on to things and keep them in boxes and in storage and stuff because it just feels good. We know where it is. We know that we have it, right? But we don't really need it or use it. We just love it. And we love, like, we know where it is. Maybe. Sometimes we don't even know, right? It's in the basement, but you can't remember what box, right? So it's like, these are the questions that you have to ask yourself. So I think it's like a combination of all of that. And I mean, like any industry, you know, there are always going to be people who are vulnerable, and there are always going to be products that are easily marketed to them, right? Like, I mean, I tell people all the time, like, there's no such thing as a minimalist table. It's just a small table, y'all. Right? But it's just like language, right? And so, I mean, I do think, you know, home organization products can be very useful and very helpful. But I think thinking that they're going to solve all of your consumption issues is just wrong, right? And I say that from experience as someone who had an excessive number of baskets and bins because I loved hiding things. And even now, like realizing that is, I cannot have anything with drawers. I cannot have anything with the lid that can hide things. I mean, like, I don't have a dresser because it's going through that self-discovery process of doing that inner work of my own psychology of ownership. I realized when something is out of sight for me, it is out of mind. So a dresser for someone is a place to, you know, organize their clothing. For me, it's just a storage facility. Like, I'm never going to go in there. It's going to be a place where I put things that I don't wear very often, right? And so you got to understand and know how and why you consume the way you do, what the challenges are for you. And I think that's, again, that's that psychology of ownership piece that's missing for a lot of people.
So I want to talk about comparison for a moment, because social media has made our idea of an ideal pretty distorted compared to our lives, what we're capable of. You know, I know a lot of people that I care about very deeply that scroll through Instagram, scroll through TikTok, and they see these, you know, young, wealthy, very fit people saying, oh, if I can do it, you can do it. What's your excuse? Why aren't you at the gym 3 hours a day? Why aren't you eating clean like this? Why aren't you doing this? And then, you know, they say, oh, I need to get healthy. And then they try to emulate the behaviors and patterns of the people that they think are guiding them to this healthy lifestyle. When in reality, if you just dig a little deeper, the reason that person is able to spend that time and able to spend that money is because they're propped up by a wealthy family or
they're being paid to do so. Yeah,
exactly. So can we talk about the role that comparison plays when it comes to our spaces, which are very, very personal things? You know, clean talk is a thing. People are addicted to videos of watching people create these beautiful refrigerators and beautiful pantries. Yeah. Well-stocked everything. Let's talk about that comparison for a moment.
Yeah, there's something that feels good about peeking into other people's lives and seeing people doing what we think is right, right? Like, oh, they're doing it right. And I think, you know, some of those things can be super helpful. Like, it can be nice to do some modeling and get ideas from some of these spaces. I think that, but it's also a slippery slope, right? It is like like you're saying, like someone being like, man, why can't I do that? Or you start feeling bad about yourself. Why can't my home look like that? Why can't this? Why can't that? Right? That's when it's problematic. And I think those of us who are on social media who have earned this unwanted status of influencer, right? I think we have a responsibility, right? I mean, I get offered a lot of free stuff, Dawn. I mean, you have no idea. Like, a lot of free stuff. And some of the stuff is cool. Some of the stuff, though, is just stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like I have a responsibility to be very mindful about what I share, on my social media. I feel like I have a responsibility, like I'm very transparent about where I purchased certain things, where I got certain things, if something was gifted to me. I mean, I only recently accepted my first brand partnership, and it was because it was literally like in divine alignment. Like I could have written the pitch myself. It was about money. It's about money and intentions. And I just remember being like, finally, something came through that I can actually do that I feel is authentic to me and the messaging that I share. The unfortunate thing is like a lot of these partnerships, a lot of the free stuff, you know, folks get paid for it, right? Because it has become a business. Anytime anything is commodified, it just gets ruined, right? Do you remember when Instagram was so fun and all we did was like share our pictures?
I remember when the most fun part about Instagram was seeing dinner photos, and my gosh, I would give my part of my liver for just dinner photos again. Just show me your dinner photos. I will look at your food.
It was so fun. I just used to like look at what my friends were eating, look at my friends' kids growing up, who was at the park, right? And so like the unfortunate thing is, you know, all of these spaces, because it allows so much accessibility to us, it's become commodified. And so what now we have to do on the other side as users is be very mindful and intentional about, you know, how much we access the space, who we're following, our time, all of these things. It was so funny. One of my friends came over last night, and she and I, we had not caught up in forever. And we were just talking about reels and all these different things. And I said something like, oh, let me just show you how I do this really quickly. And there was like whatever song came up at the top. And she goes, oh, my God, I'm so tired of hearing this song. Like everybody's using this song on their reel. And I play it. And I was like, I have never heard the song before. And she was like, are you kidding me? And I was like, no one on my, like, it was like a foreign song, right? But it just made me think like, yeah, I'm also very intentional about who I'm following. And people who I'm following are obviously not using this song to make their reels, right? And so, again, I think we have a responsibility to just be super, super intentional.
You've talked a lot about, so we talked about comparison. How conscious are you as somebody that now has a platform, as somebody who's considered a content creator, how conscious are you of the way that you present yourself and your space? Because being a minimalist creator means that your space is kind of a character that others compare themselves in their own spaces to. How conscious are you of that, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I feel like I'm super conscious. I'm definitely super intentional about what I post. But I think most importantly, it's how I respond to people. So, you know, there are the comments that are like, oh, I want my space like this, right? And I'll be like, oh, you can have your space the way it works for you, right? Or I'll get these long DMs where people will just pour their hearts out and they'll say like, oh my gosh, I've been trying to declutter, and how do you get your space like this? And then, so I think part of it too is being very intentional about how I respond to people. I also like to remind people that they're looking at my home almost 6 years into my journey. I like to throw, you know, throw some throwback pictures up every now and then to remind people. Like, I remember last year, it might have been a year before, I did a video of me organizing my linen closet. I wanted to show people, like, I'm also just a regular person, and like all of, like everyone else, my linen closet always starts really nice, and then in a few months it looks like crap, and I have to like go through it, right? And I just remember receiving so many messages on people being like, oh my goodness, seeing your linen closet just let me know that you're like normal. And like, or oh my god, my linen closet looks better than yours, ha ha ha, right? I'm like, yes, like we're all just like in this together. So I think, you know, I'm very conscious of taking off this, again, this like faux, I don't know, fantasy, like I am a very just kind of organized person in general, but like the idea that my house looks like a Pinterest board all day, all the time, come on, right? I'm sitting here drinking bubbly water just like everyone else. I'm gonna leave it on the coaster, you know what I mean? It's like, so I think am very conscious of showing my space in a real way and responding to people when I see that sort of, that they're in that space we were just talking about, right? Like that, that idealism of, or wanting to replicate and model something and really just trying to help them talk through that and work through that. So pretty conscious. And I try really, really hard in that regard.
What I like about your platform is that you do continue to talk about intention and you continue to talk about authenticity and doing what works for you. In that vein, I want to ask about a sticky confluence. You know, it feels like there's an intersection of privilege inside of that trifecta of home organization, minimalism, and tiny spaces, tiny living, mm-hmm. living with less, et cetera. You know, people with means, people with money, glamorize and commodify living in small spaces, living in ways that many people have to live. We've seen social media make stars of privileged folks who specifically buy up tiny spaces and then flip them and turn them into a business, turning them into a business that people without means who need those spaces suddenly can't afford. So let's talk about the intersection of the glamorous, Insta-worthy lifestyle of buying these tiny spaces at only to turn around and find out in 6 months that, oh, they're just turning them into an Airbnb.
Again, man, anytime anything gets commodity, I mean, I'm telling you, it just ruins everything, you know? It's like yoga. But anyway, you know, I think we all have to just, you know, be very mindful of how the minimalist movement in terms of like as a lifestyle and the tiny home movement started, right? And I think the majority of the people who are online and who share these resources and who are part of these communities, I mean, they're very authentic and they're very genuine, right? I do think there is a problem. We call it glamorized poverty, right? And, you know, this glamorizing of living in a mobile home, this glamorizing it, right? And you know, I know people that are also part of these platforms who are very conscious of it, who much like myself, like really try and speak to that, right? Like one of my friends, Renee, she's like, I know it's just super cute, you know, because me and my husband are in this, we're in this, you know, mobile home with our son and we're just this cute little family, right? And she was like, and then I have to look outside and like, I know there are other people in this park that are like, they're in this park because they have to be in this park. Like this is a lifestyle choice that we were able to make. So some folks are definitely aware of it. I think what's more problematic to me is how it lends people to think that this is a lifestyle that is unattainable and impossible to them, right? Which is why I'm really big on trying to make sure people understand that this is a lifestyle that's accessible to everyone. And I remember the first few times like reading up about minimalism and you see this bed and you're like, oh my God, that bed is so perfect. Those clean lines. This is what I've been needing. And then you click on it and you're like, the bed frame is $10,000. Doesn't even come with a mattress, right? And you're like, okay, I am not in the right tax bracket to be a minimalist. Like that's what's problematic to me. I think the tiny home movement, what it does is offer people, a lot of people who might've been priced out of some of these markets, accessibility to home ownership. I think the same about the van life movement, right? And so I think it's finding those communities online, and they do exist. There are a lot of them. Diversify Van Life is one, like love that community. You know, a lot of the tiny home builders, if you follow the builders, you have an opportunity to really see how they, I mean, they try so hard to get just the most luxurious homes into these price points, and you can like build your home online and see how much it is. I mean, I love tiny homes. I would love to own one. I love the idea of the mobile nature of it. Like if I want to move, and I remember looking at this one particular tiny home builder, And I was like, I'm going to trick out this tiny house, Don. I was like, it's going to have every, I mean, I had like butcher block and stainless
steel, sure,
like everything. And it was like $183,000, right? Mm-hmm. A little tiny home built in Oregon. So I also encourage people, focus less on the people that have the tiny homes, right? Mm-hmm. If you find yourself getting caught up in that. And look at some of the builders and look at their values and look at, you know, they're good people. Mm-hmm. They're good people because they understand that, yes, for some people, this is an opportunity to like buy tiny homes and flip them and create these, you know, online platforms to do whatever. But they understand that the majority of people who are looking for tiny homes are looking for something in particular, which is home ownership, you know, that's affordable and accessible. They really want to reduce their footprint. They really want, you know what I mean? And so, mm-hmm. like, I feel like builders, I love the tiny home builders. Mm-hmm. Those accounts are really great. But yeah, it's again, like in, you know, any industry that has become commodified or popular or, you know, a thing, a trend, there is this side to it that is super glamorized. And I do think, you know, a lot of people struggle with that. And so I would say, like, try and follow those accounts. You know, like I said, if you're interested in tiny home, look at the builders. If you're interested in communities, find communities like Diversify Van Life, where you can see people with literally, like, I just got my grandmother's truck and I'm trying to figure out how to renovate it, to, like, you know, someone who's been doing this work for a long time. But I love that you ask these questions and that you dig in so much deeper into, like, what this is, right? I mean, because again, these are the questions that we've just not been asking ourselves, right? And so people will say, like, oh my goodness, I love the book. And I'm like, I'm just saying all the things that no one else was willing to say. We were all feeling it. We were all like, who wants to live in an all-white barren space? But mm-hmm. here we are just liking all the pictures on Pinterest and liking all the pictures on Instagram, right? And I'm just the first person to be like, I'm not doing this. I'm living with color and fabric and texture, and y'all gonna have to deal, right? And so, like, but it's asking these questions that you're asking me, which I think it's so important for people to ask themselves. Like, this is how we get to the why. Why do you want a tiny house? Do you want a tiny house because you saw there's some page on Instagram that you just love following, and you're like, oh, I would just love this, right? Or do you really want a tiny house because you're trying to, there's some goal that you're trying to achieve that is meaningful and purposeful to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have to ask ourselves these deeper questions with these things. Like, why am I doing this?
I have one final question for you, and it's a bit of advice, because when I told listeners of my show that we were going to talk again, one of the things that they most wanted to ask was, and I love your platform because you bring in people into minimalist spaces and organization conversations that are not normally invited. Mm-hmm. You bring in people of color, you bring in queer people, you bring in, you know, you bring in people who haven't always been seen as folks with money or means, et cetera. So there's a level of possession where folks grew up holding on to things, typically in very impoverished families, just in case, you know, just in case that blender might be broken, but there's parts in it that I could use to repair my new blender if I need. Mm-hmm. You know, I, the one thing that I kept being told by listeners was, well, I grew up in poverty and I don't like feeling like a hoarder, but I hold on to things because I might need those parts to fix something. I might need them later on. What is your advice to people who hold on to things? What encouragement do you have for folks who want to live more intentionally, but have to exist in a hold on just in case I need a part? Hold on just in case I can't afford.
Well, I think too, that's the language there, right? You don't have to exist in that space, right? And I think one of the reasons people find me relatable is, like, I've shared stories from my childhood. I mean, I grew up impoverished as well. I mean, I think it's all of this has been like this part of my journey, right? It's like growing up, not having, being first gen and having the means to have, not knowing what to do and having too much of all the things, right? And like figuring this out. And so, like, you don't have to exist in this space of holding on just in case, right? I have found giving, at least, or I mean, it's much easier for me now. So I'm going to think back to when I first started, and I would still just be like, "Ooh, but I might, but I might, but I might." Giving yourself a time frame, right? Because the clinical definition of hoarding is holding on to something for future use. You don't know if you'll ever use it, right? And so giving yourself a time frame is usually helpful, right? It's almost like part of this work done is like learning how to trick yourself out of some of these habits and behaviors. So I'll give a few. So giving yourself a time frame, saying like, if I don't use this within 6 months, right? And then once you get to those 6 months, you let it go. Start shortening that time frame. Another thing that you can do is if you think you're going to need something, just put it in a box if you have room, right? Put all the stuff in the kitchen that you think you might need, put in a box, seal it up, and put it in your basement. And say, if I don't have to go in this box within 30 days, donate it unsealed, right? Like, don't unseal it. Don't look and see what's in there, right? Mm-hmm. So it's almost like, you know, finding ways to trick yourself. And what you realize is you're never going to use those things. Mm-hmm. You're just not going to use them because you haven't used them, mm-hmm. right? It's just this security piece, right? And so, again, it's why I like to encourage people to do that inner work, to understand their own psychology around ownership, right? Because so much of it, you know, I talk about it starting in your childhood. So much of it can be cultural expectations and pressure. So much of it can be conspicuous consumption, right? And so once you know that about yourself, that's the difference between holding the blender and being like, I just might need this, and being like, I really don't need this, right? Like, I am not in childhood anymore. Like, I'm fine. If I end up needing a piece for this blender, I literally can call the manufacturer and ask for it, right? And like just talking yourself through it, because you understand the why behind why it's so hard for you to let that blender go, right? So you gotta, it's that inner work, Dawn, I'm telling you. You gotta do the inner work. And people, you know, I think it's scary. It sounds scary maybe initially, but I mean, I haven't met a single person who has not been empowered by it. It has been the only way that I've been able to maintain my practice, right? I know that I have an affinity for a bargain. It's never going to go away because it's from my childhood, right? But I can pick up something, right? Even though, you know, I try not to be touching everything, but let's say I pick up something and because it's on sale, and I tell myself, that's why I say like, you do not need this. It's okay. And guess what? Sales happen all the time. Like, mm-hmm. people, they'll DM me and they're like, my God, I've been waiting for this couch to go on sale, but I don't have the space for it now. But I'm like, should I get it and like put it in storage? And I'm like, let's read that. Back. Right, and they're like, oh my God. And then I'm like, how many times has this store had their semi-annual sale? I'm right. Like, semi-annual sale is like every 2 months, right?
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, I you know, encouraging people to just really do that inner work and be encouraged and understand like it's a journey, it's a process. You know, celebrate these small wins and milestones. You know, join my community, become a part of a community that, you know, where we talk about these things openly and honestly. There's no judgment. There's none of that, right? Because we understand that we're all learning and growing together, right? All learning and growing together.
Christine Platt, thank you so much for taking the time to be here. The book is The Afro Minimalist Guide to Living with Less. If folks want to get in touch with you or see more of your journey and your inspiring community building, where can they do that?
Well, they can find me on Instagram at Afro Minimalist and online at theafrominimalist.com. You can also find me in your comments.
You know, I have been taking your lessons after I have been getting stuff out of storage that this wall is your doing.
I'm so proud of you.
Getting rid of things and falling back in love with the things that I own, all because of you. So thank you so much for the work that you do. Christine Platt, best of luck to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Don.
My eternal gratitude to my guest and friend, Christine Platt. Her book is The Afro-Minimalist's Guide to Living with Less. It is a wonderful introduction, or a reintroduction, rather, to putting intention back into your life. And it doesn't just extend to the things around you. And I think that was made very clear by this conversation. It's also about the people with which you surround yourself, the relationships that you build, and the relationships that you maybe say no to. It's about the jobs that you take. It's about what you're willing to say yes to and no to. It's about creating a life of intention, one that looks like you. It's a phenomenal book. I think you should get it, but I'll admit I'm a little biased. If you like this podcast and want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Share it with your friends on social media. That's free. You can also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or go a little further and leave a review. Reviews help the algorithm to show this podcast to other listeners like you. You can also help keep the show free and producing regularly by joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and a monthly book club. This month, we're reading Stiff by Mary Roach. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Or if a one-time donation is more your speed, you can buy me a coffee at coffee.com/headonfirepod. That's coffee spelled K-O-F-I. You can also connect with me on social media. I'm pretty much at Head on Fire Pod everywhere. I'm going to sign off. But before I go, remember, a refrigerator is just a refrigerator. Don't pay more because it says minimalist. Bye, y'all.